So what the international community end up doing is really providing Palestinians with painkillers and a very short-term solutions, rather than addressing the big elephant in the room, rather than addressing the root causes, which is the role of the Israeli regime in perpetuating and maintaining energy crisis.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. The siege imposed on Gaza by the Israeli regime has made the Strip unlivable in more ways than one. The worsening energy crisis in particular is affecting all areas of life. Indeed, since the imposition of the siege on Gaza in 2006, the Israeli regime has limited energy access and has even used it as a tool to collectively punish those living in Gaza. This, in addition to the destruction of energy-producing infrastructure by successive Israeli bombing campaigns, has led to acute energy poverty. Of course, as ever, Palestinians have attempted to manage this unmanageable situation, finding alternatives and navigating these extreme living conditions, one of which is harnessing solar power to supplement the dwindling energy supply. But these alternative forms of energy come at a price and can even be used by the international donor community as a way to sidestep their responsibility in holding the Israeli regime to account for the siege of Gaza and colonization of Palestine. Joining us to discuss this is our Gaza visiting fellow and energy researcher, Asma Abu Mazied. Asma, thank you so much for joining us on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara, for hosting me here.
Asma, perhaps you can start us off by giving us an overview of the energy situation in Gaza and perhaps even in wider Palestine.
I think it's extremely important to understand the energy situation in Gaza by looking at the broader picture, by really looking and analyzing and reflecting the overall energy situation in Palestine and seeing how the Israeli regime policies has been going like for decades to control Palestinian, including in the energy space. The energy crisis is not something very recent. It's not something that is happening only in the past 2 decades. It's actually has been going on for like several decades so far, since the Palestinian dependence on Israeli regime for electricity supply from the Israeli electricity company in the 70s and the 80s, until, of course, the 1994 Paris Economic Protocol that really conditioned Palestinian imports of fuel to a specific standards, usually the US and European standards, which makes it extremely and economically invisible for Palestinians to buy from other places than the Israeli regime. And therefore, it already comes to a point where Palestinians, regardless of where they are, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank, end up paying so much for electricity that they use the least in the region. And what happens is that we see a huge dependency on imports of electricity from Israel. So if we want to look at Palestinians in general, 83% of their electricity supply comes from the Israeli regime. For Gaza specifically, the electricity supplies come from several sources. One of them is the Palestinian electricity company, and of course, from electricity line from the Israeli regime. Now, there has been a point in the past 2 decades where electricity supply used to come from Egypt, but the capacity was very, very minimum. Now, it's important also to highlight that the electricity supply that comes into Gaza can barely cover 40% of the electricity demands, particularly after the destruction of the diesel-powered plants in 2014 by the Israeli regime. In summary, what we are seeing in Gaza is a very chronic electricity crisis that has been exacerbated over the past 2 decades due to the bombardment of the power plant, due to the restriction and the manipulation of fuel entry to Gaza as part of political pressure. But even looking in the future with the increasing population, that electricity crisis will continue to exacerbate. It will continue to widen. If we want to look at what are the electricity sources and what's the demand currently.
So Asma, what does this mean for day-to-day life in Gaza? What does it affect?
If you want to look at the effect of electricity crisis on Gaza, one has to understand energy poverty. And what I mean by energy poverty is really the extent to which the electricity bill, for example, constitute or eats from the household income, and the extent to which households end up minimizing their electricity consumption in a way that affects their well-being and their welfare. And this is something that happens in almost every Palestinian household in Gaza, but also in Area C in the West Bank. Now, what does it mean? It means that the electricity crisis that we are seeing and experiencing is really crippling almost every aspect of life in Gaza. If we look at areas such as wastewater treatment and the need for constant supply of electricity in order for plants to treat partially or completely the wastewater so that at least we have a clean access to Mediterranean Sea. And that's not something that happens with the electricity cut. If we look at access to healthcare, the fact that there is electricity cuts happening in hospitals and clinics, it really affects the quality of healthcare services provided. People, treatment gets delayed for a very long time, depending on the availability of electricity to do, for example, x-rays and so on. And most importantly, the increase in the daily cost incurred by Palestinians when it comes to electricity. If you look at the Palestinian household in Gaza, an average, like let's say income, is about like $340. And that's like not mentioning people who work in the informal sector, not mentioning people who work in a really precarious working conditions. And looking at the electricity bill, it constitutes about $40 to $80. And that amount is not for getting electricity 24 hours. It's only for getting electricity for almost like 12 hours, maximum like 16 hours. So it means that 1/5 of the Palestinian household income is going for electricity. And it puts families who are below the poverty line in so much dire circumstances that they have to resort to other alternatives in order to pass by the day and meet their needs on a daily basis.
Now, Asma, you've written about all of this in a recent policy brief for Shabaka. And in one part of the brief, you focus on how women are disproportionately affected by this energy crisis. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yes. Usually when analysis is being done, it treats the Palestinian community as one community without delving deeper into the needs of different stakeholders that exist. So women, people with disability, children, and so on. And in my opinion, the energy poverty that is resulting from the energy crisis has extreme circumstances and result affecting women in a very different way. If we look at the reality of Palestinian women, we find that Palestinian women are responsible for all the unpaid care and domestic work. That is cooking, cleaning, teaching children at home, taking care of the sick and the elderly, taking care of the children. And electricity is a very vital part of doing that unpaid care and domestic work. So what we see when electricity is off in Gaza over the past two decades is that women have two options. The first option is that either they intensify the labor in a very limited time when electricity is on. And I'll give you an example for that. So in times where electricity comes for like 6 hours, women end up doing everything that needs to be done using electricity in these 6 hours. So baking, doing the cleaning, doing the washing, and teaching the children if it's connected to online education. So it's a very intense labor where women end up doing so much tasks in the same time so that they can do all the unpaid care and domestic work. The other option is that when electricity is off, women tend to resort to technology-free labor, so utilizing things that does not necessarily need electricity, and that would mean taking longer time in doing things. For example, when there is no electricity, the women cannot use the washing machine. So they end up doing and washing the clothes manually, And that usually takes like 2 to 3 hours. So, or like even baking a bread, and if they want to bake the bread without having electricity, they will have to use wood fuel ovens. So that also results in a longer period of work for them, but also health hazards and long-term health diseases on the long run. So if we really want to understand the manifestation of the electricity crisis and the energy poverty, we need to look at these small details, because it might sound small, but it takes up so much of women's time. It takes up so much of their health. And also women have so much mental burden associated with the electricity cuts. And the example of how women have so much mental burden is usually happening in the summer, where there is very high heat, the food spoilage is usually very high when there is no electricity, and women end up having to cook every meal, every day, instead of like cooking for a longer period of time, or having to navigate that heat, taking care of the children who get like skin borne disease, and also managing the household. So all of that, it really affects the welfare of the family in general.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. Asma, you're right in insisting on an intersectional-based approach to this energy crisis, because it really shows us how the energy crisis exacerbates already existing patriarchal structures and also class structures. Could you tell us maybe a little bit more about how class dynamics manifest themselves in this energy crisis?
When we look at energy and access to energy, we need to think about two things: access and affordability. And looking at the socioeconomic context of Palestinian community in Gaza, you will see that over like 60 to 70% of the population are living in poverty, and 80% are depending on humanitarian aid. So that means that even if there are solutions that can lessen or reduce the energy crisis, the ability of Palestinian households to utilize these solutions to incur some improvement in their daily life is very, very limited. But also means that, for example, workers are less likely to be able to have work safety and work security within the factories in which they work. An acute example of that, the electricity issue has resulted in shifting in the working hours, has resulted in reducing the working hours in most of the factories. Now, those factory workers has lost their income, has caused a reduction in their salaries because of the working hours has been reduced. So they end up having less security. Some of them get laid off from their work, and also having less monthly income into their household due to a structural issue that was initiated and exacerbated by the Israeli regime. And that shows who bear the burden of being under occupation is usually the Palestinian household, rather actually holding accountable those who contributed to the electricity and energy crisis.
Asma, you mentioned a really stark statistic that nearly 80% of the population in Gaza depend on international aid in some way. Does this donor aid actually alleviate some of the issues caused by the energy crisis?
In terms of alleviating some, yes, it does. If we want to look at the donor aid over the past like two decades, we see examples where donors like European Union has provided fuel to Gaza electricity plant. We see also examples of Qatar and Turkey also covering the fuel bill and ensuring that there is enough diesel to supply the running of the Gaza electricity company. And we also see some aid money going into like the health sector, the education sector, and even the wastewater facilities to install some solar energy project. But if you really want to look at all of these solutions, let's say, that was provided, they were part of coping with the electricity cut. So kind of like normalizing the status quo and helping people to be okay and navigate the status quo, rather than you know, challenging the root causes of why the electricity crisis happened, or why the energy crisis actually exists in Gaza. So there has been solutions, again, even provided for small businesses, where some grants are provided to install solar energy and even farmers. But even in these solutions, there is the lack of any will, let's say, to change the status quo, to challenge the role of the Israeli regime in maintaining the status quo. And there is also patriarchal norms in terms of how this aid is being implemented.
Can you give us an example of some of those patriarchal norms that you mentioned?
Yes. So if we look at most of the aid that goes into the installation of solar energy system in Gaza, in the requirement to benefit from grants, from like cost sharing, even from access to specific solutions, you will notice several criteria. One of them is that having a small business that is usually, for example, registered, or having a land, if you are providing solar system for farmers who own like a water well, having an ownership deed for the land, or having a guarantee who can support your application if you want to get a loan. If you look at these criteria, they are completely blind to the status of women in Palestine in terms of like access to inheritance and access to ownership, but also in terms of owning businesses. So if you really analyze these criteria, it means that only those who are more well off compared to the rest of the population can benefit from these. So what happens is that we end up enabling those who have more privilege than those who are with the least privilege existing. Again, like just looking at all these criteria for these projects, it shows you. Now, it's important to note that, yes, there is always like a quota at the end of the application that says that we encourage women participation. But then like if the criteria that is put there as part of the conditions is already biased, how it's possible that we are encouraging women participation?
So in this way, the international community is often complicit in the perpetuation of this energy poverty, but also complicit in the upholding of current power structures in Palestinian society.
Yes, totally. Like the energy crisis in Palestine, donors treat it as a humanitarian or a development issues. So by preparing Palestinians with capacity building, a technical capacity building, by investing in technology-related solutions, by investing in solar power, for example, Palestinians supposedly should be able to solve the issue or lessen the amount of energy crisis that they have. And this is a very depoliticized view to an issue that is very political in its core. The issue with the electricity and the energy crisis is very political, because in order to have energy security and energy dependence, you need to have control and sovereignty over your natural resources so that you can work around coming up with solutions that is benefiting for the Palestinian community. But the whole structure in which Palestinians are living, they do not have any control over their natural resources, because the Israeli regime is controlling these natural resources. So what the international community end up doing is really providing Palestinians with painkillers and a very short-term solutions, rather than addressing the big elephant in the room, rather than addressing the root causes, which is the role of the Israeli regime in perpetuating and maintaining energy crisis. So any solution, if we want to talk about sustainable solution, it really needs to challenge the role of the Israeli regime. And it also needs to hold them accountable for all the challenges the Palestinians face. And I'll just give an example of Palestinians in Area C, where they need to have permits to establish any solar energy system, and usually they get denied these permits. But even in donor-supported projects that establish solar panels, these solar panels are being destroyed, and there is no accountability for the Israeli regime for destroying these infrastructure that has been paid by the international community.
Asma, you touched upon this briefly, but I was hoping that you could tell us a bit more about the coping mechanisms or techniques that Palestinians in Gaza are using to navigate this energy crisis.
So historically, Palestinians in Gaza has really adopted several techniques to address the electricity and the energy crisis, starting from the early days of the siege in 27, where there has been cut off fuels and people had to use cooking oil for cars as an alternative for fuel. Then, like with the electricity crisis, how people have used like candles. Then they shifted into using private electricity generator, and then like a solar energy systems. And now people are also using private engines that is part of like commercial private sector to get electricity. Now, what happens is that Palestinians really end up deploying several techniques at the same time to obtain electricity. And each technique has its own cost, has its own accessibility, and so on. But what's important, and people do not usually talk about, is what's the cost that households incur beyond the money aspect. What happens is that we end up, Palestinians are forced to normalize their life as it is, the status quo as it is, and are forced to find solutions by themselves, as if the problem has been created by Palestinians and therefore it's their responsibility to find solution for it. And what happens is that those who are not coping are kind of entitled as or titled as non-resilient or fail to be a successful innovator, let's say. That's a very problematic narrative. And this is a narrative even we see on like media with most of the success stories and the projects that we see. And to be honest, Yara, to me, the word resilience is a word I really hate. I think resilience is about telling Palestinians that they need to normalize the status quo, that they need to be okay for not getting a 24 hours electricity, for having their basic rights violated every single day. And those who navigate that the most are those who we should celebrate as like success story, as entrepreneurs and so on. And it really, the individualization of success story, it puts a narrative that those who did not succeed within these conditions are failure. And shies away from the core root of the problem, that this is a structural issue. It's a structural oppression that is limiting Palestinian lives, rather than it's an individual issue for those who were able to navigate things and for those who didn't.
Asma, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, Palestinians don't want to be resilient. They want to be free. And this focus on resilience and as you said, these independent success stories are actually not only detrimental to the Palestinian struggle for freedom, but they're deliberately attempting to cover up the complicity of the international community and really the lack of political will to change the structural issue, which of course is the Israeli occupation, the Israeli colonization of Palestine. Asma, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you so much, Yara. Thank you.
Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.